The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from a new issue of Time Magazine, dated May 11, 2026. As usual, the front cover of Time is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. It says, "Before the fall, Time, Cuba awaits Trump's endgame." So Time is in large block capital lettering in red, superimposed upon a pale tan to off-white coloration. There are dominoes stacked on end, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9, with the black dots on the white ivory or plastic. And the one in front is also stacked on end, but it has blue and white stripes, with a star placed in a triangle at the top, apparently indicating the United States is somehow involved. Okay, beginning with the brief, Oil's Slippery Future by Justin Warland. It's been hard following the minute-by-minute, day-by-day developments in energy markets triggered by the Iran war, let alone distilling the signal from all the noise. Oil takes big swings up and down on the basis of President Trump's latest Truth Social post or off-the-cuff comments. The April 17 announcement from Iran that the Strait of Hormuz would open to commercial traffic boosted the stock market and sent oil prices tumbling, only to reverse course as both the U.S. and Iran turned hostile once again. With this conflict, no matter the short-term headline, the direction for energy costs further out remains murky. Even so, it may still be possible to make some predictions. We can already see what it will look like. Long-term structural volatility. The world has woken up to a new baseline of instability in the Middle East that will not go away so long as the current regime in Iran remains and the country can control or simply block the Strait of Hormuz. By the way, that is spelled H-O-R-M-U-Z. And that instability is bound to create price fluctuations. Bob McNally, the energy analyst who founded the Rapidan Energy Group, describes the closing of the Strait of Hormuz as the loss of a key foundation of modern energy markets. Without the strait being reliably open, the whole system creaks and is bound to swing dramatically up and down. A load-bearing assumption in energy until February 28, or a few days into the fighting, was the United States will never allow anyone to restrict commercial flow through the Strait of Hormuz, he told me. This is without precedent. McNally, who wrote the book Crude Volatility, argues oil markets have depended throughout history on a stabilizer to keep price fluctuations from getting out of hand. From the 1930s to the 1960s, the Texas Railroad Commission, which regulates the state's oil industry, effectively set oil prices globally by creating production limits. More recently, OPEC took on that role as its 12 members worked together to set production limits in their own countries, thereby controlling the price. The Iran war has reminded the world of what ensues with no one to play that role. Closing the Strait of Hormuz limits the ability of OPEC's most important member states, like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, to get their product to market. That in turn limits OPEC's ability to stabilize prices. In short, we all need to prepare for persistent price volatility baked into the structure of the energy system, likely for years to come. Even if the strait opens in the short term, Iran has shown it can control the waterway whenever it chooses, and the mere possibility of a closure is enough to generate uncertainty. So, what does the future of energy look like if such volatility is part of the equation? Many people have spent much of the past month considering where energy prices may go and how that pricing will flow through to other fuels and power sources. But even without the guarantee of a persistently high price, volatility on its own has a way of shaping markets. It has long been understood oil price volatility slows capital spending broadly and at individual firms. Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve from 2006 to 2014, made the case in a seminal 1983 paper. Firms postpone irreversible investment decisions when uncertainty rises. The act of waiting has value. A 2019 study looking across 54 countries confirmed the effect at the company level. Of course, the context was different even just a decade ago. Hydrocarbon alternatives were limited and speculative. Today, a wide swath of clean technologies are commercially available and ready to deploy. And the prospect of dramatic oil and gas price fluctuations may be enough to convince investors there's a market for clean energy free of those swings. In conversations in the past 2 weeks, I heard just that. Investors do not know exactly what is to come, but they feel assured alternative fuels and power sources have a path to market. Yet, the public markets do not really reflect that. Stocks have brushed aside the prospect that turmoil in the region will persist much longer, counting on Trump to back off the hostilities. Oil prices, while high compared with just a few months ago, still suggest investors think a resolution is coming soon. But that is a tall task, and the energy wake-up call may already be happening. Cooking fuel is inaccessible in parts of Asia. Jet fuel is running low in Europe. Fuel prices are higher globally. Even though the U.S. has been somewhat insulated, the country will begin to send more hydrocarbon products to other markets, leaving costs to rise at home. At the spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and World Bank in Washington in April, the IMF warned of slowing growth and that downside risks dominate the economic outlook. We've been sort of in la-la land, says McNally. Well, la-la land ends this month. Fire over water, that's the caption for a photograph. I'll read the rest of the caption first. It's about a third of a page in color, though it's not very colorful. A blaze driven by strong winds ripped through a tightly packed community of stilt homes on the Malaysian portion of Borneo Island, April 19. Some 1,000 wooden houses were destroyed and 9,000 residents displaced from the water village, an informal settlement built over a bay that serves oil tankers in Sabah State. Authorities said they had no reports of fatalities. Okay, background to foreground, light blue sky with some white fluffy clouds. Middle foreground, houses, I guess. There are roofs, peaked roofs. Some red tile, but mostly a dark metallic color. a few very tall palm trees, something that looks like the bridge and stacks of a ship, but not the rest of the ship. And then closer to the foreground, there's a power pole that has lines, just wires, just dangling in the air. And in the front, those are the wind-blown, destroyed houses. They don't look like houses. It looks like a bunch of junk. A lot of corrugated metal piled one sheet on top of another in crumpled fashion. Those may have been the roofs of the houses, but there's no semblance of housing there anymore. The Bulletin, What We Know About the White House's Underground Bunker by Chantel Lee. A court challenge to President Donald Trump's massive new White House ballroom has thrown a public spotlight onto the supposedly secret complex beneath. In the fall, the Trump administration began demolishing the east wing of the White House to make way for the president's $400 million ballroom. The National Trust for Historic Preservation filed a lawsuit against Trump and members of his administration, arguing the construction was unlawful. After months of litigation, a judge ordered March 31 that the ballroom construction project must stop until Congress authorizes its completion, but left open the possibility that some work could continue if it was necessary to ensure the safety and security of the White House. The Trump administration now argues the project is an important national security upgrade, saying it wants to rebuild the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, PEOC, a secure underground bunker that has long been an open secret in Washington, D.C., built underneath the now-demolished East Wing of the White House during World War II. The PEOC was intended to provide security for top White House officials. During the chaos of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attack, several officials, including then Vice President Dick Cheney, were escorted to the bunker. April 16, the judge ordered a halt to all above-ground work without congressional approval, but permitted the White House to continue construction underground, including on the military complex. The Trump administration had shared little information about its plans for the facility. March 29, the president told reporters, "The ballroom essentially becomes a shed for what's being built under." A few days later, he said the construction project was necessary for the safety and security of the White House, adding, "The administration is building bomb shelters and a hospital and very major medical facilities." Administration officials have said some aspects of the project are of top secret nature. The Brief News. Good question by Connor Green. This will be in the question-answer format. What happens if banks start collecting citizenship details? American banks may soon be required to collect citizenship information from customers, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said at the Semaphore World Economy Summit April 13. And an executive order is already in process that would mandate that banks gather such information. I do not think it's unreasonable, because why don't we have information on who's in our banking system? I have a place in the UK. They want to know who lives in every apartment, he said. And how do we know that it's not part of a foreign terrorist organization? When asked for further information regarding the order, A White House official told Time, the administration continues to explore ways to protect our banking system from unacceptable credit risks and to ensure banking services remain available and affordable for all Americans. The administration did not confirm details on what citizenship information the executive order would require banks to collect or whether it would be reported to the government. Nor is it clear if the order would prevent non-citizens from opening new accounts or require banks to shut accounts of existing customers who could not produce citizenship documents. Though sources told Semaphore the order would apply to them, and the executive action is likely to face legal challenges. Already, though, experts say the impact of such a requirement could be wide-ranging, potentially creating hurdles for the U.S. banking system, as well as non-citizens and citizens alike. The exact number of non-citizens who own bank accounts in the U.S. is unknown, but a 2023 report from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, showed 96% of U.S. households, or roughly 128 million homes, were banked, meaning at least one member of the household had a checking or savings account at a bank. A report from the Census Bureau, meanwhile, estimated that as of 2022, 46.2 million U.S. residents, almost 14%, were foreign-born, nearly half of whom had not been naturalized as citizens. Efrain Olivares, the Vice President of Litigation and Legal Strategy at the National Immigrant Law Center, notes if non-citizens were unable to access U.S. banks, the economy could also take a hit. A lot of people who are not citizens, who are here on business visas, tourist visas, investor visas, do not have citizenship, are not local permanent residents, but they bring millions and millions and probably billions of dollars to this country's economy, he said. A portion of American citizens could also be shut out from banks if such a requirement were put in place. A 2023 Brennan Center for Justice survey found roughly 21.3 million voting-age citizens, or 9.1%, do not have documents proving their citizenship easily available. Depending on how this executive order reads, Olivares says, it may really prevent many U.S. citizens who do not have a passport, who do not have a driver's license, who do not have a valid ID, from opening up a bank account. Privacy is another concern. The Trump administration has drawn criticism for its moves to share data between federal agencies. Trump has sought to increase that data sharing since early in his second term, signing an executive order in March 2025 that sought to eliminate information silos and allow agency heads to have full and prompt access to all unclassified agency records, with the stated intention of stopping waste, fraud, and abuse. If agencies that work with banks gain access to citizenship data, then the information may spread elsewhere. If they can require banks to demand in some ways and hold private personal information for lots of folks, it raises the specter that the government may go after that and use it abusively to track down and harass people in communities, says Eric Rodriguez, Senior Vice President of Policy and Advocacy at UNIDOS, a Latino civil rights organization. If users' private banking information were accessed by the federal government, he says, banks could also be held liable for violating laws that safeguard customers' personal information. The potential order, he argues, would almost de facto put banks in a position to somehow enforce immigration laws. Here is the milestones page, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in the short column side, and two long ones. Resigned, Eric Swalwell, Swallwell, in disgrace, by Chad de Guzman. Fortune changed over a weekend for Eric Swalwell, a popular U.S. representative and front runner in California's race to succeed Governor Gavin Newsom, before reports of sexual misconduct allegations by multiple women surfaced. Days later, April 14, Swalwell resigned from Congress, following threats of expulsion from House colleagues and pressure from fellow Democrats, and he suspended his gubernatorial campaign. Swalwell has adamantly denied the allegations, including rape, sexual assault, and sending unsolicited nudes. He apologized for his so-called mistakes in judgment, though he has vowed to challenge the accusations legally. With the primary June 2, Swalwell's exit from the gubernatorial race left Democrats without a clear front runner, while simultaneously improving Republican prospects. California is a deep blue, but under its single ballot primary, the top two finishers advance to the November ballot regardless of party. And with the Democratic vote divided among a half dozen candidates and only two Republicans in the race, one of them, former Fox News host Steve Hilton, led in some polls a week after the shakeup. Ousted, Viktor Orban, O-R-B-A-N. After 16 years in power in Hungary, this article is written by Chantel Lee. Hungary's Viktor Orban era ended April 12, when the prime minister was voted out of office after 16 years of illiberal rule. Voters emphatically rejected Orban's far-right movement amid corruption scandals, giving the opposition TISA party, led by Peter Magyar, a two-thirds majority in parliament. Speaking to Time ahead of the election, Zsuzsanna Weh, a political analyst at the German Marshall Fund, said TISA's success had created a realistic chance to potentially reform the country, to halt the autocratization, I'm going to do that by syllable, autocratization that we've seen over the past decade and a half, and return to a more democratic way of governance. Magyar, a conservative who was previously part of Orban's Fidesz party before splitting off in 2024, has pledged to implement anti-corruption reforms in the country, saying he'd restore rule of law and give government institutions more independence. He's also promised to tackle issues such as public health and education. Whether he will follow through remains to be seen, but Weh noted that with a two-thirds majority, he would have almost a free hand to actually reform the country. If Magyar upholds his pledge to implement reforms, that could also help repair Hungary's relationship with the European Union, which has grown increasingly strained under Orbán's leadership. In 2022, the EU began suspending billions in funding to Hungary over violations of its rule of law standards. The release of that funding would not only help the nation's struggling economy, but also send a positive signal to voters in other member states where right-wing populists are challenging the EU standards. In an interview April 16 with the Patriota YouTube channel, Orban indicated he would not step down from leading Fidesz, but said the party was in need of a complete renewal. All right, now to the news in the small sketches on the left-hand column, margin, really, of the page 1, WON 1, a half marathon in Beijing by a humanoid robot, April 19. Lightning, the robot, finished the race in 50 minutes, 26 seconds, beating the human world record, 57 minutes, 20 seconds, held by Jacob Kiplimo of Uganda, TAPPED, T-A-P-P-E-D. Apple's head of hardware engineering, John Ternus, to succeed Tim Cook as CEO in September, the tech giant announced April 20, imposed a cap of 2,708 daily flights at Chicago O'Hare International Airport this summer, a cut of as many as 372 flights per day by the Federal Aviation Administration, April 16, to help prevent widespread flight delays amid construction. Oh, dear. Announced April 16, Todd Lyons, acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, plans to step down at the end of May. Agreed by the Trump administration, April 13, to fly the Pride flag on a federal flagpole at Stonewall National Monument in New York City, 2 months after it took the rainbow flag down. Oh, turning the page here to photographs. I'll just, three are so dark I won't try to describe them, but I'm going to describe one. And I'll read first the description. Space Launch System, SLS, moon rocket roars to life at 6:35 p.m. EDT, April 1, producing 8.8 million pounds of thrust, a figure that bests even that of the Apollo era's Saturn V, which had a 7.5 million pound punch. Less than 10 minutes later, the crew was in Earth orbit. Okay, we are looking at the flat land of Florida's east coast. There's a river here. I think it's the river. It might be the ocean, as in the Atlantic, but I think it's the Banana River. In the background, now this is just becoming dusky here, 6:35 p.m. on April 1st. The sky is still blue, but it's changing to gray with white clouds in the background. There are two tall towers, like communication towers, like the TV towers in the Raleigh area. And there's a water tower that's much shorter, like half the height of those, what I think are communication towers. There are birds. There's a big flock of birds way off in the background in the blue sky. And those closer up, flying right over this body of water, are really close to the camera, but they're fleeing. And right up next to the camera, on the left, there's like a bush. We can see the foliage on it. This is Florida. And on the right side, there's a lower bush. And then there are huge, massive clouds. Not clouds in the sky, but clouds caused by the firing of the rocket. At this point, the rocket has already cleared the top of the rocket control tower, where the rocket is stationed when it's not flying somewhere, when it's silent and still. And the clouds at the bottom are caused by the fire that's fueling that rocket as it ascends into orbit. Here's a page with seven questions. Margaret Atwood is being interviewed. This will be question and answer format. I'm going to count now to make sure there are seven. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, I'm counting eight. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There are 8 questions, even though it says 7. Shannon Carlin wrote this, and there's a photograph in black and white of a, I'm going to say, little old lady here. She's got really pretty fluffy hair. It's in black and white, so I don't know if the hair is blonde or gray. And bright eyes, and she's smiling, almost smirking at the camera. She's wearing a dark jacket with a medium-colored scarf tied around her neck. It might be red. Again, this is in black and white. Okay, Margaret Atwood, the author on Trad Wives, Double Agents, The Power of Teenage Girls, and Hulu's adaptation of her 2019 novel, The Testaments. Do you have any desire to return to Gilead with another sequel to The Handmaid's Tale? Answer. That's going to depend on how things turn out. So what are the bright notes of today? I would say the Hungarian election is very interesting. It has shifted the balance of power in Europe already. The other big story is how Ukraine has reshaped warfare. Question. You said you wrote the testaments to show what happens when a totalitarian regime collapses from within. What can the book and now the TV show teach us about organized rebellion? Answer. There is a lot of literature on resistance movements and people who are active in them. One of the big stories of the 20th century, and it's probably going to be one of the big stories of the 21st century, is double agents, or people working from within to bring down a corrupt regime. That's Aunt Lydia. That's what she became. Question. One episode tells the story of how Lydia became the most powerful aunt turned mole in Gilead. Do you consider her an anti-hero or a villain? Answer. Oh, this is good. That's bad. It's rarely completely true. Most of us live in that in-between area. It's also true the good that people think they are doing can have very adverse effects. Question. The story is focused on the girls being groomed to become the wives of Gilead's most important men. They're being taught how to look prim and proper while pouring the perfect cup of tea. Are you familiar with the online subculture of trad wives? Answer. Oh, yeah. But when you say trad wife, you're not talking about women in the 19th century. If you were a farmer, you had to have a wife. You could not run that thing without somebody doing the cooking, gardening, keeping the chickens, the quilting. These were fairly marginal operations. You needed somebody who knew how to use up every leftover, repurpose any form of cloth. That's very far from what people thinking that they are trad wives now are doing. Question, how would you describe what they're doing now? Answer, well, it's a little bit like Marie Antoinette playing at being a milkmaid. It's not really a milkmaid, although trad wives do a certain amount of this and that. They are by no means a 19th century runner of a household. Most trad wives exist in families with a reasonable amount of money. Otherwise, they would not be able to afford to do this. Question. The message of the testaments is, there's nothing more powerful than a teenage girl, but most women do not truly understand the power they had then till they get older. Is there something you learned later in life that you wish you had known when you were a teenager? Answer. I don't know. A lot of the things I did a sensible person would not have done. Deciding I was going to be a writer at the age of 16, I mean, that is not an adult thing. Especially in Canada, at a time where there were no visible writers. So where did that come from? I think ignorance is often your friend, because if I had known how difficult it could be and what the chances were, I probably would not have done it. Maybe ignorance really can be bliss. Oh, that's a statement. That's not a question. Answer. It can be. Willful ignorance is different from just not knowing stuff. A lot of adolescence is that. You are trying things out to see if they work. It is not true that you can be anything you want to be. That is just not true. I could never have been a ballet dancer. I got dizzy on the turns. Question, what is the best part about being in your 80s? Answer, friends and family. One good piece of advice, make younger friends, because a lot of your older friends are going to die. They are not going to be with you. If you do not make younger friends, you are going to be pretty much alone. And that's about Margaret Atwood. The Brief Health. This spring, stop and smell a flower, by Angela Haupt. Whoever first suggested stopping to smell the roses was on to something, but there's a catch. Not all roses smell good to all people. Our response to scent is deeply personal, shaped by memory, culture, even genetics. What matters more than what you sniff is figuring out which smells resonate, then giving yourself enough time to experience them. Deliberately sniffing something is almost like an act of mini-protest, says Kate McLean McKenzie, a designer and researcher at the University of Kent in the UK, who maps smellscapes around the world. It's like I'm not going to just look at it, I'm actually going to bend down and sniff it. People will look at you strangely. But when you do, your heart rate slows, your nervous system shifts, your mood lifts. Olfaction is among the oldest of our sensory systems. It evolved long before the cortex, the brain structure responsible for rational thought, ever developed, research indicates. Part of what makes scent so powerful is how differently the brain processes it compared with other senses. Mood change is one of the more common effects of smelling something, says Pamela Dalton, a cognitive psychologist with the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, a nonprofit research institute. Olfaction has a more direct impact on emotion than any other sense. When you inhale, odor molecules bind to receptors in your nose and travel to the olfactory bulb in the brain. Unlike touch, hearing, or vision, which all pass through a relay station called the thalamus before we are conscious of them, smell skips that step, connecting straight to the limbic system. That is the brain's emotional center, where memories live. Here's how to tap into the power of scent at home. One, there are five of these are available. One, luxuriate in scent for at least 30 seconds. There is a difference between a passing sniff and an intentional one. Spend at least 30 seconds actually calming your system down and really inhaling and thinking about it. McLean McKenzie advises it's not a long time, but it is possibly more time than most people give it. Two, try smell catching in your neighborhood. McLean McKenzie leads smell walks in which small groups walk a short distance and pay special attention to what they smell. You can do the same on your own, and you do not need a curated route. Just walk slowly and wait for scents to come to you. Inhale deeply when something catches your attention. Challenge yourself to get low, get close, engage with the environment the way an animal would. 3. Rotate your scents by mood. Sweet, powdery floral scents, think lavender and rose, trigger relaxation and a calmer mood. Citrus, pine, mint, other sharp or cooling scents tend to be more energizing. Scent has these effects partly through the trigeminal nerve, Dalton says, which registers sensation as well as smell. That can shift your mood because it's part of the touch system in your body, but it happens to be in your nose, she says. So when you smell something strong enough, it will activate both the smell system, but also this other touch system, and that sensation can be arousing. choose your scent based on the headspace you seek. 4. Switch off your screen and your brain. One great thing about bending down to sniff the daffodils is that you cannot do it on a screen. Digitally, you cannot transmit a smell, McLean McKenzie says. It means you have to engage with the outside world to be able to get the best experience from it. As you detach from your screen, try quieting your thoughts as well. A smell walk is meant to be an embodied, holistic experience, she says. It is about not trying to rationalize it all the time, but actually just responding. Your associations are your own. What matters is that you notice them. And 5, pay attention to what changes. Smell is also a health signal. Shifts in how things smell to you or a sudden loss of scent can be early indicators of illness worth flagging to a doctor. Head injuries, conditions like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease, run-of-the-mill colds and sinus infections can all contribute. Movies by Stephanie Zakarik. A casually extraordinary film about art, pride, and generosity. One of the best films of the year, so far, was not made by a brash newcomer, and it does not come with a costly ad campaign. Steven Soderbergh was the hot young director back in 1989, the year his debut, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. And he's been hot on and off since, at the helm of hits like 2000's Aaron Brockovich, or riding the crest of the Oceans franchise. Now he's one of the few major directors making smart, entertaining movies for grown-ups. The latest is The Christophers, both modest and extraordinary. The setting is modern-day London. Laurie Butler, Michaela Cole, an art restoration expert and accomplished forger, gets a request from an old art school classmate, Sally, baby reindeers, Jessica Gunning, and her brother Barnaby, James Corden. The money-grubbing offspring of a legendary painter. He's best known for several series of paintings known as the Christophers, which have fetched millions at auction. Apparently, there's an unfinished Christophers series lurking in one of his townhouses. Sally and Barnaby want Laurie to ingratiate herself and complete the paintings. They suspect their father's going to kick the bucket soon, and they're desperate to secure some kind of inheritance. So, Laurie, having presented herself as a potential assistant, infiltrates the fortress of Julian Sklar, Ian McKellen, a cantankerous eccentric decked out in a series of knobbly old Shetland sweaters, aristocratically rumpled overshirts, and jaunty neck scarves. Julian's digs are a glorious mess, a little like he is. The walls of one room are dotted with splashes of paint, as is the door, having been pushed open a million times with painty fingers. But Julian has not painted in years. He makes money by recording crotchety cameo videos. Laurie cagily tries to flatter him. He does all he can to make her go away, though he admits he's susceptible to flattery. He finds out more about what she really thinks of him, which only makes him respect her more. Meanwhile, she locates the unfinished canvases and gets to work, though it is not long before she decides to shift the course of her deception. The Christophers is a wily little movie. It is not trying to be about anything, which means it ends up being about lots of things. It is about punctured pride, about the rarity of people who call us on our baloney, about both the meaninglessness and eternal value of art. It is about pettiness as one of the worst human traits, and generosity among the best. The pleasures of the Christophers involve following the cagey cat-and-mouse game Julian and Lori are playing, only to see it transform into an uneasy yet unbreakable union. In one scene, Julian tries to dismiss one of his own works, and Lori shocks him by articulating exactly how he has brought technique, form, and emotion together into something remarkable. It is a dazzling high-wire monologue, and Cole delivers it as if she were writing a zephyr. McKellen's always good and often great, but there's something offhandedly magical about his performance here. Julian has a stockpile of peevish bon mot, yet he's also joyously louche, having long ago entered his DGAF era. The Christophers is largely a comedy, but it is also about all that we gain and lose with age, how we sometimes need young people to bring us back to ourselves. Simultaneously meticulous and casual, it is the kind of movie only a master filmmaker could have made, though it's doubtful Soderbergh thinks of himself as a master. Last year alone, he gave us two terrific pictures, the understated spy caper Black Bag and the affecting ghost story Presence. He is like a jewel thief in reverse, dropping off the gems and vanishing into the night. This is how you make the kinds of movies people did not know they wanted, which are maybe the only movies worth making at all. The View Nation, Birthday Wishes by John Garrison Marx. Marx is author of Thy Will Be Done, George Washington's Legacy of Slavery, and The Fight for American Memory. Our disagreements about the history of slavery are never simply about the past. They are about what we believe America is, what it stands for, who belongs within it. The nation has never been one thing to all people, and our commemorations inevitably reflect that reality. But federal planners for the semi-quincentennial clearly have little interest in acknowledging the central place of slavery in American history. Under President Donald Trump's leadership, statues of enslavers have been brought to Washington, D.C., while the administration trumpets projects like the Founders Museum and traveling freedom trucks that minimize or ignore the founders' involvement in slavery. Exhibits and publications about slavery have been removed from National Park Service sites, and grants that explore the history of the institution have been cut. And Freedom 250, the initiative leading the White House's anniversary celebrations, gives short shrift to the impact of slavery. This is not new. The 1932 George Washington Bicentennial offers a particularly revealing precedent. Planning began in 1926 with a nationwide address from President Calvin Coolidge, broadcast to what was then the largest radio audience in American history. Coolidge argued earlier generations had placed Washington on a pedestal, transforming him into a rather imaginary character shaped by a universal desire to worship his memory. The result, he warned, was that the real man among men had been obscured. Over the next 6 years, Americans set out to rediscover the real George Washington. The scale of the effort was staggering. Newspapers published millions of articles. An estimated 16,000 commemorative programs took place every day during the nine-month celebration. Washington's presence saturated American life in a way unmatched before or since. Yet amid this flood of programming, the mostly all-white planning bodies erased Washington's involvement with slavery. but African American activists, intellectuals, and scholars shared their own visions of Washington's legacy. W.E.B. Du Bois, for example, published a pageant, a common form for sharing lessons from Washington's life during his bicentennial, that placed Washington's enslaving front and center. One scene depicts Washington taking roll call of the people he enslaved at Mount Vernon, while in another, Washington is upstaged by black patriots of the American Revolution. Scholar Walter H. Mazzik's 1932 book, George Washington and the Negro, was likely the first devoted to Washington's history with race and slavery. The George Washington Bicentennial may canonize St. George on his 200th anniversary, wrote Carl Murphy, publisher of the Baltimore Afro-American. But for the facts, you'll prefer Mr. Mazzik's book. These interventions were not simply about correcting the historical record. They were efforts to use the past to demand that Americans confront the realities of racial injustice in their own time, particularly the violence, disenfranchisement, and denial of civil rights so common in the era of Jim Crow. By centering slavery in their interpretations of Washington, black Americans sought to claim a fuller place in the national story and to press for a more just future. Even with the full weight of the federal government behind them, federal planners still could not eliminate discussion of slavery from the anniversary. No single top-down narrative was able to silence competing interpretations of the past. Americans argued, challenged, and reshaped the meaning of the commemoration in real time. We have the same possibilities today. Across the country, history organizations and community groups are planning their own efforts to mark the 250th anniversary. A new exhibit opened at George Washington's Mount Vernon encourages visitors to engage with Washington's history of enslavement. The Declaration Book Club, hosted by Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, explores the history and legacy of the Declaration of Independence without shying away from the centrality of slavery to Jefferson and the nation. Even the center-right American Enterprise Institute's We Hold These Truths initiative thoughtfully engages with the contradiction between the soaring idealism of the founders and their deep involvement in the institution of slavery. Our history makes clear, anniversaries do not belong to governments alone. They belong to all of us. No administration, institution, or single group of planners can fully define what the past should mean for the people of the present. There's a photograph here. It's not really very large, maybe a quarter of a page. It's in color, but it's also nighttime in the photograph, so it looks really dark. I'll read the caption first. The Washington Monument kicks off the semi-quincentennial, December 31, 2025. It's dark, okay. It's nighttime in Washington, D.C. on the Mall, where we see the pinnacle that is called Washington Monument. You can see the lights of the city. You can see some of the buildings very well illuminated. On either side of the pool in front of the Washington Monument, one sees a row of trees. They're dark. Don't know. It was in December, so I don't know if they're defoliated or not. But then is the pinnacle, the Washington Monument. Well, I have to tell you, it is gaudy. Okay, it's lit up in colors that are mostly red, white, and blue, but I'm seeing some yellow and some purple in there also. There are flags flying in front of it. The lighting on the monument shows a lot of flags flying in front of it, the U.S. flags. But we have at the top the purple, and then coming down some stripes in blue and white and red and white, and then a star in blue that's outlined in white. Now, this is on the monument. This is not a real star. Then 250, top to bottom, placed vertically, and that's in red, outlined in yellow. This is all lit up really brightly. And then another horizontal stripe in white, and then another smaller star in blue, outlined in white. And then another red, white, and red horizontal stripe. Then the last pattern is horizontally striped white, blue, white, very dark. I'm guessing it's very dark blue that has escaped the direct lighting. So that's the Washington Monument at night on December 31st, 2025. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.